Welcome to episode 7 of the X-Men TASS podcast. My name is Willie.
And my name is Bobcat Goldthwait.
Yep. Bobcat has replaced Sonya this week. She is in Bogota, of all places, believe it or not. But she'll be back soon. We don't have Bobcat Gold... How do you say his last name?
Goldthwait.
Is it Goldthwait or Goldthwait?
I think that there's a something in between the D and the Goldthwait. I think it is.
Okay, whatever. Your name is Matt.
My name is Matt. That's correct.
Yeah, and I've known you since how old we were?
Negative. Question mark. Negative 2. I think that we knew each other even before we had a physical presence.
Oh, is that so? I don't think that's true. Okay. We knew each other since we were 4 years old. Is that safe to say?
Either 4 or 5, yes.
Okay. And now we're still, we still hang out in rooms in the same presence like 30 years later.
From time to time, it's a bit odd, but yes.
Yes. So, you're our special guest this week. You are our first special guest.
Ooh.
And my first special guest question to you is, what is your... Or what was your familiarity with the show, your like of the show, your history with the show? Tell us about you and the show.
Thank you for that question. I would be happy to tell you about my history with the show.
I mean, people don't just want a guest star that like knows nothing about the show.
That's
or
true.
Didn't care about it.
That's true.
Well, I mean, but if that's the case, then we're still going to have you.
I would say that when was the what's the exact date of the opening of the show, or at least the year? Do you know what it was?
Yeah, 1992.
1992.
It's the 25th anniversary.
In 1992, we were 8 years old.
Yeah.
So what I would say is that back then, in my little 8 year old's Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You know, which started, you know, most of the good stuff, there's a checkbox next to it, and it was checked. Food. I had access to food. I had access to shelter. I had the love of my family, very fortunate in that regard.
Did you have access to white privilege?
I had lots and lots. That's baked in. That's completely baked into this entire premise.
Okay.
So when I was, let's say, 8... Or I remember maybe even 7.5 because they started teasing this show.
Yeah.
If you remember that.
The tease was huge.
And it was quite a bit before the show actually arrived.
Now, I don't have a specific memory of the teasing of the show, but I do have the vague memory that this was like, I knew this was going to be the greatest show of all time.
So
we must have talked about it.
It could be a sort of exaggerated... you know, exaggerated by the mind of a youth.
Right.
But as I look back now as a 33-year-old, right. I feel like it started getting teased, you know, basically an eternity before the show actually
yeah.
started.
Okay, well...
And I saw these little commercial snippets.
Yeah.
You know, I think incorporating the, you know, the famous theme song of the show...
yeah, that's right.
So these like little 30-second or 60-second commercials about like, oh my god, kids, prepare yourself.
Right.
There's going to be a show about the X-Men.
Well, in the first episode, which you clearly listened to, I pointed out that I seem to remember they had the pilot first, and then the real eternity was waiting for when the show was actually picked up. And
did they replay the pilot a few times or something?
I don't know how many times they replayed it, but I remember the pilot being a massive deal. And then I remember there being like literally a billion years between the pilot
yeah.
airing and when the show actually started.
I don't remember the pilot specifically, but I do remember the Chinese water torture eternity.
Yeah. In kid time, it really could have been 2.5 months.
Or even a week. Who knows? Yeah. It was like next week it went up.
Yeah.
But I just remember – and this was a time – I think you guys – I did listen to the first your first episode. I think, you know, recognize this was a time before Google searches and Wikipedia and whatnot
yeah.
where it's like –
It's like how did we know anything?
It's like I took Amtrak on the way up here
yeah.
and there was a delay boarding on our stop. And when you don't know what the delay is, it's like pure torture. when you don't know when that train is going to come.
Yeah.
It is like the definition of torture.
Yeah.
But then when an Amtrak person came around and said, it's all a total mess. So when the Amtrak person came around and said, "Hey everyone, like here's what's up.
There's a dead
I'm
moose
sorry
on
for the
tracks.
Delay. The dead moose needs to be cleaned up." And
Northern New Jersey has a wild moose problem.
Right there's just meese everywhere, and so we're gonna, expect for the train to board and leave in roughly a half hour.
Right.
Now that's something that I could get my mind around.
Right. Now,
but if it's just an open delay of
then you're waiting
potentially
for
limitless exactly.
Yeah.
So
and then you just might as well kill yourself.
You might as well.
Yeah.
So to put things in perspective, back when I was 8 or 7 and a half or whatever years old, we had no idea.
Would you say that knowledge is power?
I would say that.
And would you say that quote plays a big role in this episode we're about to cover?
I would, actually. All right,
we'll get to that.
I would. The knowledge of the motivation behind these generations.
Anyway, you just spent 10 minutes talking about how you waited for the show. Can you tell us anything about the show that stuck out to you, that you enjoyed, that you appreciate, that you hate, that, you are totally indifferent to?
I guess that for me, the show was the first instance in which I had, you're 8 years old or whatever. You've only been like somewhat of a formed human being for, let's say, like 2 or 3 or 4 years or something like that, not counting 0 through 4 or 5, which is in my mind just a human no man's land. So it's sort of the first instance for me where I had this thing that I knew and loved, which was the X-Men comic book series.
Isn't
something that I, really gravitated towards, that was part of our childhood culture.
It's just weird that would be so ingrained before the cartoon, because I felt the same way. It's like, oh yeah, fucking Marvel, the comic books, X-Men, of course. Yes, it's a great idea. It should happen. Like, and I have a lot of opinions about it as an 8-year-old.
Right.
And that's just bizarre looking back. Like, how is us at 8, like, had so many thoughts about it before it even, like, aired on television? You would think a kid would get all his opinions and facts from TV, but there was no X-Men on TV before the X-Men.
No, I mean, unlike today, in which everything is some bizarre digital balkanized.
Right. You can imagine how a kid today.
We had a community back then. You rode your bike to the to the comic book store. You bought a Bazooka Joe for a nickel, and you talked about the war.
And Marvel comics were just they must just have been self-evidently awesome.
They were.
It was a truth we held to be self-evident.
They were.
That all X-Men comics were great.
Yes, and I think that our parents were like at the very least happy for us to be like out and about. Participating in commerce, riding the bike, reading things.
Right,
if they weren't Tolstoy, they were at least words on a page.
Right.
And so that was just sort of the natural order of things. And then when the show came out, it was mind-blowing in a way that this thing that you love that's very familiar to you and this environment and culture of conflict and beauty and relationships and is now manifest in a another medium, in a popular medium. And it was just so just the idea of, and so but, mm-hmm. I think the payoff, though, the idea of it was incredible, and thus the horrible weight and the pain of the weight, but then the payoff that it was actually good.
Right.
That it was actually compelling.
I mean, I still think it's good. We just watched episode 7, Slave Island.
Great segue.
Did you enjoy yourself?
I did.
Yeah. I mean, here you are as 33. You're completely jaded. You've got,
jaded to the max.
Right.
I did.
Okay, good.
Obviously it is a cartoon show designed first and foremost for children.
Yes.
To sell, sugered cereals or whatever on Saturday mornings.
I mean, it has a
it's
real
a little
serious
hokey,
tone
but I think
children.
It does. Yeah, it does.
It's just kind of bizarre. That's like still the most. We were watching the intro and the theme song, and I was like, "Damn, this show is not fucking around." The X-Men are so deadly serious in this opening,
right? Well, I think that's where all plaudits are due as an adult. As it stays true to like what the X-Men, what the deal is with the X-Men, which is about.
I said another episode. This is like the true first huge swing by Marvel of trying to present their content in a serious manner,
right?
Because up until this point, any cartoon they had was like pretty goofy. and stupid, like the Spider-Man show from the 60s, which was really cool in a way, but it was, you know, it was like really like, it wasn't like pulled from the comic books.
Yeah.
And the same goes with like other random shows they'd have through the 70s and 80s.
I think also if you contrast it with, I don't know if and this was a couple years later. I don't remember the exact timelines of these, but when did the Power Rangers come on?
It was like a couple years later. I think they were like 1995.
Okay.
Maybe early 96.
So I think of the Power Rangers probably as the other, like, break... I could be missing one or two or whatever, but as, like, a breakthrough, like, Fox, you know, sensation for kids, which really didn't present that many, like, difficult, you know, like, difficult questions or, themes or, truths and untruths and... the search for meaning in mutant life.
So you think X-Men was even a little deeper than something like the Power Rangers?
Much deeper than the Power Rangers.
It was pretty. I think it's pretty intelligent show for kids.
The Power Rangers was like, how do we take?
It's like the Earth. You know what Power Rangers is? It's like the precursor to Pokemon. Like totally meaningless bullshit about trying to get kids just to buy the product based on nothing.
You know, you may have just offended half of your listeners. I personally was not. I'm not fluent in the world of Pokemon. I never really got into it.
Well, I guess I'm not either. So don't be offended if you like Pokemon. I mean, I'm not. I don't have a strong opinion about it. But it just let's talk about this episode a little bit. I want to do a brief recap because you haven't been watching them in a row like I have. So in the last episode, it was called Cold Vengeance. We saw Wolverine go off to the Arctic to get away from the X-Men. He runs into Sabretooth. He tries to kill him. Wolverine has to end up saving this whole tribal village. It kind of ends on a bummer because the whole village is destroyed, and this Inuit village, the council decides they have to live in the city now.
That's some deep shit.
I know. That's what
this
I said.
Like this is some serious shit right here.
Yeah, and Wolverine's like kind of happy because they call him a friend, but really their village is destroyed and they have to live in the city. It's pretty sad and dark ending.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the subplot of that episode was that Storm, Gambit, and Jubilee were going to Genosha to check it out because Gambit heard rumors that it was a good place for mutants, that they welcome mutants onto this tropical island somewhere in South America, we can presume. It's not a real place.
Which is like a classic, I mean, classic trope and classic reality of like people that are, you know, discriminated against.
They're
looking for the next thing and it ends up being a trap. It ends up being, you know, not as good as it was a...
just like people who went to San Francisco, there was a big earthquake and they all died.
Yeah, and you're exactly... You're exploited in some way.
Right. No, you're right. That's like That's like a theme across history. People, they migrate to a new land for a better chance, and a lot of times they're persecuted in a new way that they hadn't expected.
Absolutely.
But anyway, so we're on this island of Genosha. And so this episode opens in the previous episode it ended where Storm, Jubilee, and Gamma get kidnapped by Sentinels. The whole Genosha Hotel Resort is in on the government scheme to kidnap mutants.
Right. Like even it's sort of an open question with the whole – they never really answered the question, you know, what is the deal with this place?
Right. Like, in the last episode, I was talking with Sonya. I was kind of like curious like if the hotel clerk guy who is the one that alerts the government – the fact that mutants are at the hotel, like, what is his salary?
You mean, does he get a commission? Is that what you're asking?
Well, I'm just wondering, it's like, on the one hand, he's like this completely devious, like, scheming bastard of a pure Nazi type who is, like, doing, like, horrible, intrusive background investigations on hotel guests.
Yes.
But on the other hand, the rest of the day, he must just be seeing regular human guests and checking them in and, like...
He's...
I'm just wondering, like, what kind of salary that is, where they expect you to, like, lead this double life, you've got a normal, boring career, but then a secret, horrible career.
I don't think we know anything about the Genosian economy in general.
Anyway. Well, they need slave labor, as we find out.
Right, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so this episode, Slave Island.
And that's had serious repercussions on other sides of the labor market, including this guy.
Right.
That's, I mean...
He's co-opted into the slave, like, economy of Genosha.
Yes.
So the episode opens, we're at the Genosian, like, mutant slave base. They're building a dam. And we're immediately introduced to this idea of these collars that the X-Men and other mutants have to wear. They're constantly beeping in the background. They're pretty sinister.
Yes.
So the idea is that as long as they have the collars on, one, it takes away their mutant powers, which is insane.
Yes.
And then two, if they try to remove the collars or escape, the collars explode and destroy them.
Yes.
Not the word kill or decapitate, because that the show mainly uses words like destroy.
Although it's still pretty, like, that's
a terrible image.
Well, that's only because they have to, though. I think kids get it.
Yeah.
Like, there's a collar around your head.
Isn't this some bleak shit for a kid's show?
I mean, it's, you know, yeah.
I mean, this is
why it's real.
Yeah, this is one of my. It's why it's one of my favorite episodes. I mean, that's like a fucked up premise right off the bat. These horrible head exploding collars they have to wear.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the collars don't make sense. Like, we see the Blob as one of the mutants, and he wears the collar, but it's not like he's not the Blob.
He's the Blob, right? So if it exploded, he'd probably be like, you know.
Yeah, the Blob has like invulnerable skin, technically,
right.
And also. I don't know, like, so much of his power is about, like, the size of his body, too.
Right.
But, so, he puts the collar on, you think, like, maybe it would shrink his body, but it doesn't. It doesn't, like, alter them physically. There's another character in there, I think her name is Wolfsbane, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if she was a member of X-Force or X-Factor, but she's, like, this, like, horrible-looking, like, feral wolf woman, kind of like Beast in a way. She doesn't change into, like, a human when she wears the collar. She still maintains her bestial appearance.
Are those her basic, you know, attributes or, you know?
I don't know. I mean, she's like the Beast. She's just like a physical animal type mutant.
She's not like Mystique or something where Mystique couldn't.
Oh, by the way, we see Mystique. And
we
she's
do.
Like
little
blue
guest appearance.
So when they take away her powers,
maybe that speaks to
So there's some other
that
mutants.
Power is blunted.
There's a lot of like guest star mutants, which is actually really cool to see as a kid. There's Sunfire, this Japanese mutant who can control fire and like fly around using fire.
Yes.
There was
and subtle racism.
Right. He's racist because his outfit is like the flag of Imperial Japan.
Yes, and he's got like very slitted eyes and I mean, you know, who knows?
Well, he was definitely a racist character I think he was introduced in the early 70s. He was extremely...
So, like, slightly less racist in X-Men the Animated Series.
Yeah,
versus,
well, because
like,
they don't get into him that much.
Right,
In the comic book, he first appeared in Giant Size X-Men number one. He was extremely... He, like, openly distrusted, you know, I don't know how to put this delicately, but just white people in general. He was still holding a grudge from World War II. Let's just put it that way. And the writers of the comic painted him in a negative light, too, showing him as, like, some sort of old, like, Imperial Japanese asshole that, you know, hated Americans, and we should hate him for having been that guy.
Okay.
So there's a lot of weird cultural negativity around Sunfire. But he's not really – that side of him is not highlighted that much in this episode. We also see another sort of racially insensitive mutant stereotype, Thunderbird.
Yes. Although it's strange, I mean, I wonder, you know, how much those... I'm not as familiar with the character as
right,
you,
yeah.
But in that time,
yeah.
You know, if you were, you know, of Native American ancestry or something, you know, is that something, you know, positive that, you know...
I don't think, you know, to
be represented.
I mean, the way he... In this episode, he
hard for me to assess with my current...
Right. In this cartoon, they just... He's just a cameo and he doesn't say anything.
Right.
In the comic books, it was definitely troublesome.
Okay.
He's like
a vicious, like tomahawk swinging, scalping people or something.
He's not portrayed in a positive light. He actually dies like three issues in after his appearance.
Okay.
And you know he's kind of like Sunfire. He's painted in a white man's. Un-PC view of Native Americans.
Gotcha.
And then we also see Avalanche, who we'll see in a few episodes. He's like this mutant that wears this weird silver like helmet and silver bodysuit, and he can cause like earthquakes in the ground. We see Mystique in a wordless role, who becomes a major character in a few episodes down the road.
Is that the first?
Yeah,
Mystique?
That's the first. I think Mystique we see.
Ah.
Yeah. And this Mystique is not like the Mystique that you know in the movies. Like, this Mystique is more like out of the comics. She wears this weird, like, white dress over her blue skin and has, like, I think it's either a necklace of skulls or a belt of skulls. I forget.
Making it very clear that she's a villain.
Yeah, she's
like,
bad.
We just like to establish this very clearly.
And then we see some, like, other minor mutants. Like, we saw Caliban, who was recently featured in Logan.
Yes.
And he was also in X-Men Apocalypse as well, but played by a different actor. Mm. In Logan, he was played by Stephen Merchant, which was like kind of interesting.
Yeah, I found that to be a no spoilers, but a fine performance.
Great character in that movie.
Yeah.
So we get like a nice menagerie of like other mutants, and the weird thing about seeing them all to me is that the Genosian the Genosian military just lets them wear their superhero or supervillain outfits.
Yes.
doesn't provide them, you know, like fatigues or, you know, prisoner outfits.
I mean, there's no scene in which they're stripping them naked and then covering them in lye and then spraying it off.
Right, yeah.
There's no horrible like prison shower scene and prison uniform.
It. Yeah. And so, you know, so they're in this prison camp, and the whole goal is the Genosian military structure wants the mutants to build a dam. And the dam, as we learn, is to power a sentinel factory.
Yes.
So the Genosians are producing sentinels. So in the first two episodes, we learn that we think the X-Men have destroyed the sentinel factory. But as Gambit says, there's more gators in the bayou. There's always more gators in the bayou.
He's just chock full of really, really insightful, you know, Louisiana,
bio,
whatever.
Bayou.
I don't even know what to call it.
Yeah, Cajun wisdom. Yeah, he finds a way to appropriate Cajun wisdom.
Although
to
I will find that
thing the X-Men face.
One Cajun person I'm very close to, like, does have frequently just lots of hilarious, insightful things to say like that. So,
well, how
it actually seems to comport with my reality. So,
I have a really dumb question.
Yeah,
it's also speaking about being racially or culturally insensitive.
Proceed.
I guess that's the theme of this episode.
Proceed.
Is Cajun? If you're Cajun, do you speak Cajun or do you speak French? Or is it its own? Is its own language? Is it like a hybrid?
Well, I think it's more of a description of a people,
right?
Who I'm going to do a bad job of this. It's the French Canadians that came down to Louisiana after being expelled from that area for I don't even remember why, from whatever, you know, political or territorial reasons.
So they're like
a long time ago.
Sort of like the Puritans.
So they speak. So they speak now, as I understand, at least from the Cajuns I know, they speak English or something very close to it. Although it's difficult for me to understand when I go down to Louisiana.
It's a certain patois.
it's a variant of English, let's say.
Okay.
And some of them might still speak French, but yeah.
So you don't. So you're saying it's like more just like it's like a weird combination of French and English.
It's like a cultural demographic
right.
type thing.
Okay.
I don't know if Cajun is a language. I don't think.
Yeah.
It
okay.
Is. I think it's.
This is something you can easily Google,
appeal.
But I choose not to. and so. Right. So it's a pretty evil scheme that the Genosians have going
yes.
here. And immediately, so what the Genosians plan is they want to they deactivate the collars so the mutants can use their powers to work on the dam.
Yes.
And the second they do this, Storm immediately rebels and tries to escape.
Yes.
And she's immediately put down by Sentinels. And when she's captured, they're about to kill her. But Gambit persuades the Genosian guards not to. He says, "You don't know what she can do. She can control the weather."
Right.
And
like
Storm.
All these other folks are just like bending pipes for you. They can move
Storm.
Concrete blocks as like basic utilitarian
right.
slaves or whatever.
Storm
but
could get this damn
Storm,
going.
Yeah, she can really get it going.
And then that's when Storm really freaks out at Gambit. "Don't tell them, Gambit. Knowledge is power." And that's the line that we hinted at. Oh, and then
I didn't really understand that, by the way.
Yeah,
what is the?
Well, I'll tell you in a second. Actually, I do understand. And
okay.
then, but right after she says that, the sentinel that it's holding Storm says, "Be silent,"
yes.
because he's still listening to Gambit explain his scheme.
Right, he's very convinced.
He's like conversationally involved.
He was highly convinced.
It's the sentinel. It's Gambit. It's Bolivar Trask, the scientist running the place.
Yes,
and like the guards are all having a conversation.
Yes.
So I just like how the Sentinel just like chimes in with like, he's like, "Hey, shut up! I'm listening to Gambit."
I mean, the Sentinel knows how to take yes for an answer.
Yeah,
and he's done. He's done with the conversation.
Right. And then you know, this just leads to my question. So you know, we hear some of the Genosian guards sort of talk at the X-Men, and like, who are these Genosians? Because they seem like Americans to me.
I don't know. I don't think it's. I don't think the show ever.
I mean, they're Caucasian people for the most part.
Yes.
You know, they've got American accents.
It could be one of those like weird islands off the coast of like South Carolina or something like. You know how there's islands like
they somehow formed a breakaway like, republic from the United
yeah,
States.
There's like Catalina Island off of California and Los right. Angeles. Yeah. There's like some. There's all these weird islands everywhere.
Yeah. So you think it's one of those deals? It's like an island. It's an island of culturally American people have formed their own.
Without the facts, that's my guess.
Right, and they're led by this guy who calls himself the leader, who was once a colonel.
Yes,
but he likes to remind people that he's known as leader now.
He was once a colonel?
That's what they say in the episode. Okay. He says, how are you doing, Colonel? I am known by a leader now. Never forget it.
Then I have an alternate theory.
Okay.
You know, like in The Rock?
Wait, hold on.
Okay.
Just describe this guy first.
Oh, the leader.
Yeah.
He's just sort of this, like, he's multicolored. He looks like sort of a parliamentarian from the 18th century.
Right.
He's got a nice coif of hair.
You think that's a wig?
I guess it might be a wig.
Yeah, he's wearing like a British parliamentary wig.
Yes. I guess that's
but he's got modern 1990s eyeglasses.
Yeah, and just
so he's
sort
nearsighted.
Of sort of a multicolored
but kind of a poncy outfit.
Yeah. Very strange.
Yeah. And what were you going to say?
I was going to say that if he used to be a colonel, maybe it's a situation like The Rock where he goes and takes over an island to extract you know, someone has been, you know, cheated of some sort of military benefit.
Right.
So he and his, I don't remember the exact plot of The Rock, but I think it's like that. So he and his compatriots, they take over the island, but they win this time instead of Sean Connery, et cetera, taking him down.
And then the U.S. government
and then
just
it's
says,
like, this is your island. We're not going to deal with this anymore. And the island just sort of slowly evolves into it has a civil society now.
Right. And so the X-Men are captured. Storm's now thrown in a prison like a solitary confinement box.
Yes.
A sweat box. She's got claustrophobia, so that's really bad for her. And it's this point where the X-Men back home in Westchester are a little bit worried, and Cyclops tries calling them. He slams down the phone in frustration, and he says, "Remind me to never buy stock in the Genosian phone company."
Yeah.
Which led to my question to you, which I want you to answer.
Yes.
Does Cyclops play the stock market?
I think that he has the disposition. Like, I think he has an analytical mind.
Right.
It wouldn't surprise me if he is a saver more than a spender. And
I mean, he looks like an early '90s like white guy that would work on Wall Street.
This is the peak of maybe not quite the peak, but the precipice of the the individual day trader.
Yeah.
It wouldn't surprise me if Cyclops did a little playing the stock game outside.
I mean, he's engaged to Jean Grey. He's probably thinking about a future.
Yeah,
he wants to.
Although I don't know what's the compensation of an X-Men really like. You're volunteering for Charles's Foundation school or something.
All right, this is the Sonya bashing episode because she never wanted to get into this.
Oh, this is the only thing that I want to get into.
Yeah.
So.
I think that Professor X. Is a billionaire. And I think he gives them all like gold cards and they can spend whatever they want. That's one of the perks of being an X-Men. You get to live in the mansion and he gives you a credit card where you could literally like while you're not being an X-Men, which is a stressful job to be in this deadly paramilitary group.
Oh, yeah.
He lets them go out to malls to buy clothes, cars. They all have convertibles and really fancy clothing. So my question was...
You think it's pretty significant, the compensation.
I think that they're... I don't think it's like they're compensated. I think they just have access to Professor X's bank account, which is in the billions.
Yeah.
And my question to you is, where does Professor X get his money from?
And
I have my own theory.
So I don't want to corrupt this assessment or this podcast with the canon or whatever after the animated series. But
right. No, you can.
I think it's sort of left... I don't think it's as detailed in the comics.
No,
I don't think it is. Total open question in the comics.
That's why I like speculating on it. I'm sure at some comic of the 10 million it was answered.
Right.
But my theory is that I think it's you just assume that Professor X, on one level he inherited his wealth because he inherited.
Well, that's
that mansion,
what the movies.
But he needs way more money than just whatever wealth he inherited.
Because he does.
Yeah, because he builds like stealth fighter jets and like underground hangars and computer equipment, and like that must cost billions of dollars to get all, and the uniforms must not be cheap.
Well,
all that spandex.
Here's my assumption that
at least
the movies sort of make it seem like he inherited he grew up in that gigantic mansion.
So he's rich to begin with.
He's an orphan or whatever. Yeah. He's totally, you know, unbelievably rich to begin with.
Right.
He went to school to study science, whatever.
Well, he got his doctorate at a very young age.
Yes, but, I don't think – and then he went after that. Although I guess, this is all filled in by the movies, and we don't really know in the comics because he comes in at an older
right. –
like, we don't know if he had his, like, two decades of, like, successful scientific research, like, founding a couple companies
or whatever.
Well,
where do you think he has the money from? I just want to see if we had the same answer here.
I think that he has the money from inheriting because I think that that's part of what builds a lot of, you get the same, it's also a common trope in comics, like with Batman, you have your privilege,
a
special responsibility to give them pay it forward or whatever
He's operating a Batcave situation, basically, just like Batman.
I think so. Yeah.
Just his inheritance. Okay, this is my...
I think he's insanely wealthy.
I think he had an inheritance, but then I think he used his mind powers to play the stock market.
That would be quite...
I am so convinced of
this. And then what? Then he is like...
He just plays the stock market.
But that's morally... That presents
problems. I think that's like one of the few moral things he broke because he knew he needed a ridiculous amount of money to get this X-Men project
off
the
ground. Is that driving his guilt towards now doing
something? No, not at all. I think he just thinks that it's perfectly fine. Like, this money is not coming from anywhere. I'm just playing the stock market.
It's perfectly fine to fleece
who's
American. He's fleecing pensioners and the California teachers.
Maybe he's
union
enriching them by
Wall Street, whatever.
Does
playing
the stock market hurt others?
It doesn't. I mean, it. Technically, playing the stock market
well... played the stock market well, are you thereby, putting people under your boot? I don't think so, necessarily. If you know what stocks to
pick... I mean, we're getting into, a metaphilosophical thing about boats, about all boats rising. But I think that if you're... I think that if you play the stock market in a way that that advantages you, that other people do not have an advantage of, thus, why insider trading or whatever is illegal.
You think it's just unethical?
I think that is unethical, immoral, whatever you want to call it.
As we discuss in this show, Professor...
So reading people's minds would probably be a step further than insider trading.
The ethics of Professor X in this show and in the movies is actually extremely, extremely troublesome. Yeah, it's like one of the hallmarks of this show. It's like sometimes he decides to read people's minds. Sometimes he says, "I respect other people's privacies, not to read their minds."
Right.
You know, he's just like constantly. His rules are always changing about his ethics, and
that's what's so scary about Professor X.
Yeah, he's like a really like
that's why that's
like,
why the government is and everyone is so terribly concerned about this highly dangerous mutant.
Well, I mean, it's funny you say that. In the very early 60s comics, like when we first meet Professor X, he has very close ties with the government. And they trust him. And my theory about that, too, is that he also mind-controlled them to trust him. He doesn't want the government on his back, at least that early on.
I see.
Professor X in this episode, he leaves a very – it's worth noting. The X-Men are going to Genosha to check on their friends, but he refuses to go. He says, "No, I have things to do. They're probably fine. Get lost." And Cyclops, gives a look of worry. And
it is really rather brief. He really is
cryptic.
Screw off.
Yeah, and he's contacting Moira MacTaggert, I'm Your Island.
Yes.
Who we'll get to learn who that is much more in the next few episodes. But anyway, back on Genosha, Jubilee has this plan to rush the guards. I mean, this is her plan. It's pretty bad. It's just to rush the guards when they turn the powers off, steal one of the control devices that activate the collars, and go things about that way. But...
I mean, it would have worked,
Right,
It wasn't that far from working.
It's not that far from the ending of this episode either of what the X-Men actually do.
Right.
But Gambit, she tells Gambit about this plan. He takes it upon himself to betray her.
Yes.
Which, plays into the theme of his characterization, can we really trust Gambit? Because he's a former thief, and he kind of plays on his own side. He's a card player. You can't trust card players. He's really good at card tricks.
Can't trust those, you know, Mississippi River
right,
card, card dealers.
More culturally down on you.
They're always trying to pull it over.
So Gambit, like, he alerts the Genosian, like, leadership to Jubilee's plan. Jubilee's rebellion is easily quashed. Jubilee is then thrown in the confinement box too with Storm, and she has an emotional breakdown because Gambit betrayed them.
Yes.
But then Gambit gets to meet the leader.
And Jubilee also has sort of a special thing with Gambit.
Yeah. Well, she looks up to all the she looks up to Wolverine and Gambit because they're cool.
Yeah.
You know, they're cool older dudes.
Yep.
But Gambit's like the fun one on the team. You know, he wanted to go to Genosha to hang out on the beach.
Right.
But so Gambit gets to meet the leader. Bolivar Trask, the head scientist who invents the Sentinels, Gyrick, the money man behind the scenes, and he gets to go to the Sentinel manufacturing floor where we see Master Mold.
Master Mold.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, I mean, what is Master Mold?
It's a good question. It's a really good question.
I mean, what is he like? Just before like figuring out what he is.
I mean, is he a?
It's a giant Sentinel.
Yes, it's a gigantic sentinel, slightly stylized in a different
it's
way.
Got like
so
a
you
yellow
make
crown on its head.
The viewer understands that this one is a special one, right. And he just sort of like births other sentinels. I think so. Maybe Master Mold is a she. I think that should be considered.
Oh, I've never
considered that.
I mean, he has just the same voice as the other sentinels, which is hilarious.
Yeah, well,
which I like too. I like that.
We shouldn't be so quick to
attribute gender to a computer. Voice.
That's right.
Right.
And, you know, other than that, Master Mold just sort of seems to sit in the same was built
in the
sitting
throne.
Position.
He's already got like a lordly manner to himself because his role is to sit in a large chair and he bakes sentinels in his stomach.
Yes.
And so for some reason, Trask, the scientist, thinks this is a better way to manufacture sentinels.
I don't know why. It just sort of seems like a facade, like a thing that's at the front of a gigantic assembly
line.
It's
like building like a giant robot over an assembly line.
Yeah.
It's as if Henry Ford built his factory out of a car.
Yeah. And there's a car at the other end. A gigantic car opens up its hood and then a car pops out.
Right. And so, you know, but Master Mold is insidious though, because I mean, despite it being sort of impractical, I guess it is producing sentinels at a greater speed, but it needs a lot of power. That's why they need the dam to power the factory.
Yes.
Because the sentinels require at least 21 gigawatts of...
Yes. Yes, they do.
All right, and then Gambit, he lets the leaders know of the mutant rebellion plan, and he promises to tell them more about the X-Men. They're going to transfer him to another facility. He's floating. He's driving in like a floating car or something. I mean, it's not a floating car. I think it's a Jeep. I don't know where I get a floating car from. And he escapes by distracting the guards with a card trick. And when he escapes, all of a sudden the convoy is attacked by Cable.
Cable.
Yes. So we are introduced to Cable with his awesome like musical themes too.
Yes.
Da-na-na, da-na, da-na-na.
Cable is just a total badass, and it's very gratifying to see him in the cartoons.
Yeah, it's interesting that they give his backstory in this episode. It's immediately retconned like two episodes later. Mm. We'll get into that then. But like in this episode, his backstory is that he decided to fight in the leader's army to fight for democracy on Genosha. But then when he found out that the leader wasn't the patriot of democracy like he thought, he threw his wages in the leader's face and ran to the hills to start a revolution of his own. So,
and when is this?
It's funny that he was taking payment from this guy, but...
When is this in the time chronology of going back and forth in the future? Because I'm very bad at keeping track of that.
So spoilers, that's not Cable's backstory. His real backstory, as we learn in like two episodes later or the next episode, I forget when, we'll find out, is that he's a time traveler from the year 3000 or the year 4000 actually. And he's back in time on various adventures to stop. You know, I mean, namely, he's there to stop Apocalypse, but, you know, we haven't met Apocalypse
yet.
Did
he go back too far and thus got involved in this whole imbroglio?
Well, I don't know, like...
By accident or something?
I think maybe we're to presume that, like, he was doing this mission with the leader on Genosha because it's related to Apocalypse
somehow. Yeah, it could be, yeah.
So, you know, he has, like, other secret motives. And I don't know. It's just kind of like – it's just like Cable is just such an amazing – like you said, like an awesome badass.
Yeah.
As evidenced by his incredible gun from the year 4000,
yeah.
Which is also terrifying.
Yeah.
His gun, he like charges it and he can shoot any object and the object fills with energy and explodes. So
I guess it's not unlike Gambit's, you know.
Yeah, it's similar to
it's
Gambit.
It's like a, yeah. You know, projectile Gambit power, yeah. Or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, and Cable's backstory is even crazier than that because he's also the secret child of Cyclops and Jean Grey sent to the future. I know, yeah, the show hints at that at some point, but they never really. I don't think there's an episode that specifically deals with that. So his real name is Nathan Summers, and like his mother, he has the power of telekinesis. But like he doesn't really use it that much on the show. Occasionally he does. In the show, he's mainly just shooting his gun, and he's got a big cyborg arm, and he travels through time.
The thing about Cable that I found, you know, and yeah. continue to find really appealing is just of all the characters, you know, they've had their battles. They've had, you know, all their, you know, their trials and tribulations. But yeah. with Cable as the character where you're like, this guy has seen some shit.
Yeah.
Oh, where
yeah.
it's like, this guy has seen some shit, and he carries it like yeah, that.
He is
like,
gritty as fuck.
Yes.
And, right, he has really seen... He's seen, like, you know, without getting too much into the spoilers, he's just seen, like, society collapse. He has seen, you know, slavery and genocide.
He's seen the worst of the worst.
Like, you know, dealing with Apocalypse as his main enemy, who is the most, like, genocidal maniac, most powerful mutant there is. You're right. Cable is, like, so, like, hard... bitten to the bone.
Yes.
And he's really cool. I look forward to him in Deadpool 2 because he's going to be the co-character in that.
Interesting.
And seeing Cable on the big screen, if they make him just like this, he'll be a really good foil for Deadpool. And also introducing the time-traveling element will be good for Deadpool because then maybe he can interact with the various different X-Men casts. That'd be kind of funny. I bet they do a joke like that. You heard it here first. And also, last thing I want to mention about Cable is, like, he's unconcerned about the butterfly effect.
Oh, yeah. He doesn't give a
shit. He'll just, like, kill people, blow stuff up, you know. It's like the famous Simpsons episode where Homer has a time-traveling toaster, and just because he steps on a bug, the entire feature's different. Like, it rains donuts,
yeah.
And people have lizard tongues. Like, Cable's not concerned about such trivial details.
No.
And which is weird, because it turns out he has a son that he's never, like, worried about endangering his existence either.
I think it's just too much burden for, like, a 19-minute
right,
cartoon.
Yeah, I guess. But the point is, it's, like, it's just vague enough to, like, to allow you to imagine these questions, yeah. You know. And that's part of the brilliance of the show, in my opinion. And then, so Cable frees Gambit. He gives Gambit the magical key that unlocks the collars. Gambit stealthily reinvades the damn base. He frees Storm Jubilee. And then... they regroup Jubilee, Gambit, and Storm. They reinvade the dam again, free the mutants, attack the Sentinels. All the mutants are free. They, you know, this time they do a better job. You know, they pretty easily, all those mutants, they pretty easily dispatch all the robots and all the heavy artillery of the Genosian Guards.
There's a little moment of a saved murder.
Right.
You know, there's a murder about to take
place.
Yeah,
Blob's about to kill somebody.
Just about to full-on murder one of his captors.
And Storm says, "We cannot endanger human life," or she says something like that.
Something like that. It's a little, nice little lesson learned for the kids.
Yeah, Storm is not a murderer. And then Storm's plan is to destroy this whole dam by creating, like, an enormous, like, hurricane. And Jubilee's concerned because Storm is weak from exerting herself and being trapped in that cage for the past week. But Gambit says, no, Jubilee, we have to leave her alone. And literally a second later, the ground Storm's standing on collapses, and Storm would have died.
She would have, yes.
Right, so Gambit a little short-sighted there. But if not, Rogue flies in to save the day. The X-Men have figured out what's gone on, and they save their friends.
Yes.
Which makes you wonder if, like, if Gambit, Storm, Jubilee did nothing and were just imprisoned, the X-Men would have saved them eventually anyway.
I guess. I mean...
Their whole rebellion didn't seem, like, worth it.
Once the market closed.
Yeah, once Cyclops was done day trading.
In New York. They would have got right on that.
Yeah. And then,
Do you think, sorry to interrupt, do you think that dam is used for other, like, you know, civilian hydroelectric projects on
well, they have a whole resort community there.
Yeah.
So, like, yeah, man, now maybe the resort's ruined at the very least.
I just wonder about the, you know.
Yeah, I know. So they're being a little bit selfish by...
I get why they... I would have destroyed it, too. I get why they had to destroy it.
The Genosians are Nazis. There's no doubt. And then Cable goes to kill the leader. Right before the leader's getting lint brushed off his jacket.
Yes.
Cable goes...
He is quite a dandy.
Right. So Cable's about to kill him, but then a huge tidal wave crashes on everybody. You presume they're dead. Cable's laughing the whole time. We know in a future episode that Cable escaped because he can body slide or travel through time at like a moment's notice. So Cable's going to be fine. Let's see. What else happens in this episode? Oh, a Master Mold tries to escape the oncoming tidal wave.
He has a bit of a, you know...
So his foot is still
plugged
in. There's
a little physical humor.
Yeah. Master Mold's plugged into his chair, and he says a terrifying thing that only would... Like, that would scare any robot. He says, "I am still plugged in!" Before he's presumably destroyed, but actually he's not. Spoilers, Master Mold comes back too. He's a recurring villain. And then, so everything seems fine. The X-Men are flying back to the mansion, and when they get there, they discover that the mansion is destroyed. End of episode. Another cliffhanger.
Yes.
That will confront our mutant friends going forward.
Very ominous. How many times has the mansion been destroyed?
It's a very common thing.
In the comics...
Yeah.
In the animated show, in all of the movies.
Many times.
Many times the mansion's been destroyed.
And it's always rebuilt the same way, too.
Uh-huh.
Which I'll talk about more in the future episode. I'll just talk about it right now. So, I've just rewatched X-Men Apocalypse.
That was about to be a really nice tease, too. Like,
I like to give people what they want.
Yeah, great. You're a champion of the people.
Bryan Singer, who I've mentioned, watched every episode of the show to prep before doing the X-Men series.
I've heard that.
He blatantly ripped off the show again. Because in X-Men Apocalypse, in the end, the mansion's destroyed. Apocalypse destroys it. But at the end, he shows Magneto and Jean Grey using their
powers.
Everyone's
like working together to move the lumber and the concrete and
exactly ripped off.
And also they have such photographic memory of all of the like architectural blueprints.
They just can like reassemble all the like disintegrated dust into
whatever. I'm not gonna hate too much. Willing suspension of disbelief.
It's just
and all
a funny
bullshit.
Trope that continues that they rebuild the mansion with mutant powers.
Yeah.
The and that's what this episode's all about is mutant powers are good for construction work.
That's right.
If you're a mutant, you are highly prized. And that's actually a theme in the next episode. The Unstoppable Juggernaut, where we meet our friend Colossus. And I won't say too much about that there, but let's just say there's more mutant powers employed for the use of everyday construction work.
Yes. And you can learn that and much more on the next episode of the
X-Men TAS podcast. Thank you, Matt, for joining us this
Absolutely.
Week.
It's been a pleasure.
Oh, I want to say before you go, you can find us on Facebook, the X-Men TAS podcast. Just search out that Facebook group. We'd be happy to have you as a member. Ask us any questions. Find me on Twitter at Willie Simpson, at Willie Simpson. Download and subscribe to us. We're on any place you can get podcasts. Rate us 5 stars. Tell all your friends.
Thank you.
All right, that's all I got. So good night, everybody.
Take care.